The Anesthesia Podcast.
Hello, my name is Seema Agarwal. I'm one of the editors of Anesthesia. We've got some great speakers here today, and we're really going to be discussing the issue of gender equity in anesthesia as a career option. And this has all come about because of two papers that we're publishing in the coming weeks. The first is called A Successful Return to Work in Anesthesia After Maternity Leave. It's a qualitative study. It comes out of Australia. The second, from a similar research group, talks about how gender affects a career in anesthesia. It's called Still a Boys Club. And so I'm delighted that we've got the authors of these papers with us here today. So I'm just going to introduce those to you. The first is Cara Allen. Cara is an author on both the papers. She is the head of education and a specialist anaesthetist in Melbourne, where she's also a clinical associate professor. So good evening, Cara. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Seema.
Our second author who's joining us is Claire Stewart. She is an author on the Boys Club paper. She's also the chair of the Gender Equity Subcommittee of the Australian and New Zealand College of Anaesthetists. So good evening, Claire. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our third author is Jane Carter. Jane is the first author on the paper looking at gender equity in careers in anaesthesia. She's an anaesthetist at the Austin Hospital and is also a member of the Australian and New Zealand College of Anaesthetists Gender Equity Subcommittee. So thank you very much for joining us, Jane.
Thanks.
And our final guest is Lauren Feld. Lauren is actually, it's very early in the morning for Lauren, 6 a.m. in Massachusetts, where she works. She's a gastroenterologist at the University of Massachusetts with an academic focus on workforce gender equity. She's got a leadership role in the Department of Medicine, focusing on structural solutions to support workforce gender equity, including parental leave policies and the creation of a family-friendly environment. So thank you very much for joining us, Lauren, especially so early in the morning.
Thank you for having me. It's a great start to my day.
So, Cara, I think if we could start by asking you just to summarize your return to work paper and what you found.
Thanks, Seema, for having me on the podcast. And thank you to Mark for in advance for the editing. So, as you said, this is a qualitative interview study that was looking at the experiences of women returning to work after maternity leave in Australia and Aotearoa, New Zealand. And so we essentially, we're aiming to improve the process of returning to work for women, particularly after maternity leave, but have some baseline principles that might be helpful for anybody who's returning to work after any type of leave. So whether it's parental leave or sick leave or anything else. And we found that leave duration impacted the return to work process, that most clinicians had to initiate that any planning for returning to work, and it wasn't necessarily initiated by the workplace. And that looked like things like list planning, returning to after hours work. We came up with this concept of a graded return, which was gradually increasing hours over a period of time to kind of ease back into clinical work in particular. We found that workplace culture was a huge influence over returning to work, and in particular, whether there were visible department role models for people who had had time out of the workplace. Not necessarily parental leave, but parental leave was particularly remarked on. And there was a significant career impact, both in their clinical space and in the non-clinical space in that return to work process. And there was also a really significant emotional impact. Many of the participants in the study described a quite strong emotional impact that lasted for some years after the return to work process. So it was very powerful interviewing the participants of the study. I'm so grateful for them for giving their time and being really open about their experiences. And I'm really excited to see it published in Anesthesia.
Oh, it's really, it's great for us to have it published in Anesthesia. Thanks so much, Cara, for a really great description of your paper. Jane, could I ask you first to summarise the other paper looking at gender equity, and then we'll open the whole thing up for a great discussion, because I think the two papers work really well together.
Yeah, thanks, Seema. So this paper, the Boys Club paper, is a qualitative exploration on how gender affects a career in anaesthesia for anaesthetists in Australia and New Zealand. And its results come out of a larger survey that was conducted by the Gender Equity Subcommittee of the Australian and New Zealand College of Anaesthetists. That survey asked a range of questions about all kinds of domains that could be impacted by gender, and that was distributed to all genders, so men, women, and those identifying as non-binary or gender diverse. And then from that survey, which had, so I think with 470 responses from about just over 1,200 anaesthetists. We then did a thematic analysis on all of the free text comments as part of that survey. So there were a total of 793 comments, all of which were analysed. And then from that thematic analysis, we generated three significant overarching themes emerged. And they are, number one, that gender effects on the career family interface. And this one's really looking at how women described a significant and negative effect of parenting on their career progression. And we noticed that that was observed across all stages of career. So from training through to consultancy, and that this had quite broad implications for career in terms of access to challenging or subspecialty lists, access to private practice, the way that less than full-time work is stigmatised, and the impact of taking parental leave and returning from parental leave on career progression. And interestingly, what we found for this area was that women frequently describe this sense of having to make a choice between career and family, and that sense of choice wasn't described by the men participants. And the second theme we've called women don't fit the mold. And this really captures the sense of, exclusion or peripheralization that women experience in a male-centric anaesthetic workplace culture. And that's where this idea of the boys' club mentality comes in, or this idea of in-group bias. And this theme also looked at some of the implications of that sense of not belonging and how this affects, again, women's access to things like leadership opportunities or research, as well as clinical opportunities, and also address some of the clinical and professional undermining that plays out as a result of this. And I think unsurprisingly, but obviously disturbingly, we saw that these experiences of marginalisation were very much magnified for women of ethnically and culturally diverse backgrounds. And then the third key finding, or the key theme that we identified, was this concept of gender equity changing the status quo. So this theme really acknowledges that gender equity is sadly not the norm in our anaesthetic workplaces, and that working towards gender equity is complex and challenging. And this theme looked at some of the reasons why that's challenging, so some of the barriers that exist to implementing gender equity. It also looked at some of the enablers and arguments in support of gender equity. And I think a key thing that came out of this theme, which really underpins the whole gender equity discourse, is the idea that gender equity requires a sense of redefining and de-stereotyping our definitions of success with a view to benefiting people of all genders, not just women.
Thanks. That's a fantastic summary and a great paper. We're really looking forward to seeing it in early view soon. So if we could just start the kind of discussion. So Carl, really, I mean, how did this research come about?
Thanks, Seema. So the UK is well ahead of Australia in terms of recognising the challenges of return to work and addressing that through, you know, a variety of things like less than full-time training and courses. But 10 years ago, there were no sort of courses or programs to help clinicians return to work after extended leave. And for our purposes, that was anything more than 12 weeks, which I appreciate, you know, sounds like a lot, perhaps if you're sort of thinking in FMLA terms. But in Australia, you know, maternity leave, paid maternity leave is at that stage was about 8 to 12 weeks for most states. So I personally had a reasonable return to work experience after my children, but in talking to other practitioners, I was finding that people having sick leave and coming back to work, or having children and coming back to work, that wasn't the norm. And so we were fortunate to have some contact with the team that run GAS Again and learned a bit about what they'd experienced in setting up a course. And our course looks a bit different in terms of the content, but the principles of restoring confidence when you've had time off work and re-engaging with the workplace and thinking through the kind of workday and the practicalities of getting back to work after you've had time out, all of those principles are the same kind of underpinnings of the course. So we've had approximately 300 critical care practitioners through our course. It runs in Australia and Aotearoa, New Zealand. We have had a lot of sort of feedback and data that's come through in terms of the way people have experienced return to work using the resources that the course provides, as well as being more comfortable with being a role model for returning to work, which was one of the findings from my paper, that that's a really critical influence in the workplace for people who are coming back after extended leave. So we've about to celebrate our 10-year anniversary of CRASH. We've got faculty across, as I say, Australia and Aotearoa, and we're hoping that in improving the return to work process, that we're addressing a critical career inflection for practitioners that might otherwise disengage from the workplace, and we might lose people due to attrition, or we might not be able to engage people fully in both clinical and non-clinical work.
Lauren, if I could bring you in here, Cara talks very eloquently about the situation in Australia. I would imagine it's very different in the US, but similar themes coming through?
Absolutely. So I'm slightly jealous of the mandated paid parental leave in most other countries, because the US doesn't have that. And so we have a guaranteed 12 weeks of unpaid leave through FMLA, but there's no sort of national paid leave laws. So return to work can happen at a much shorter time frame. And with this, we see that a lot of the return to work concerns are dominated by a lot of logistic concerns, especially if someone is lactating, and based on career hours, finding adequate childcare to cover working salary can be really challenging. And we have a nationwide retention issue in medicine in the U.S., and I imagine that you're facing similar struggles. It's certainly been exacerbated by the COVID pandemic. And so in trying to think through ways to make staying in medicine or in clinical medicine an acceptable career option for people who have, particularly women who have had children, I think that the sort of things you're describing are essential to maintaining the workforce.
So in the return to work paper, you have a very nice diagram about things that we can do to try and have a successful return to work. And I just wonder if we can talk through those, Cara. And so the first is the workplace culture. What kind of findings did you find about the issues of the workplace culture that we could start to improve?
So I've mentioned one of them, the role model aspect. So there was this real distinction between people who felt that they were having to kind of blaze a trail of returning to work. And, Lauren mentioned that those practical aspects of childcare that cover the working hours and the breastfeeding. If nobody's done that before in your workplace, that's really challenging, no matter when you're returning to work. There's also that aspect of, that people who had come back after sick leave, which is obviously a different cohort to this paper, that managing fatigue and managing, the cognitive load of medical appointments or a change in professional identity in connecting to work. And so that workplace culture of having a bit of a cushion around the practitioner when they first come back. And certainly for people returning from parental leave, it's such a short period of time. The really positive experiences that women had, the workplaces recognised that a bit of extra support in that space was incredibly helpful. One of the other things that I put in that space was provision of adequate leave, which Lauren's addressed. And I might touch on that a bit later, because that was a really interesting finding throughout the study. And then I've included a piece from Mari Bismarck, who's a researcher who's now living in Aotearoa, New Zealand, about explicitly recognising the capacity, credibility and capability of women. Because I think often when people return to work, their confidence is very low, but there's absolutely no evidence that their competence is affected in the short term or in the long term. So people describe feeling rusty, but also recognise that they're back up to speed really very quickly, despite sometimes quite long periods of leave. So, early recognition to sort of say, hey, isn't it great that, this person's back? We're really looking forward to seeing you back around the traps again. Let me know when you're ready to re-engage in the workplace. I know that you're capable of it. You might just need a couple of days or weeks or however long to get your feet under you. just really simple, they don't have to necessarily be formal, but even those informal kind of boosts to confidence can be incredibly helpful. And in fact, career changing, people described, you know, that happening when they first returned to work and that affecting their long-term career engagement.
One of the other things that you highlight is the kind of working day and after hours work. Can you expand on that a little?
So the working day piece, I mean, this was fascinating to me because there are laws in Australia about, you know, people having jobs to go back to essentially after maternity leave. So that was really surprising to me to find that people were finding that they weren't necessarily having a job to go back to. They're being hired on a locum contract or a contract that would terminate if they went on parental leave. And so that is, you know, that's obviously quite concerning, both from a workplace culture and from, you know, having that consistency of work perspective once you are ready to come back. In terms of the working day itself, you know, the after hours component, when people first went back, that felt like a very unsupported space to be in, particularly for women who'd moved from training years to those early consultancy years and were consolidating their specialist practice. That's a really, that's a big kind of transition period in your career. And so women often felt more comfortable coming back in hours. And that, you know, that is kind of a trend that we've seen through crash in people coming back after sick leave and other types of leave as well. And particularly that those kind of periods of unplanned overtime. So the you know, 10 or 12 hour day that blows out to a 14 or a 16 hour day when, you know, if you've come back after sick leave, for example, your fatigue might get intense after about 12 or 14 hours of work. And so trying to minimize that kind of unrostered overtime and plan for relief and breaks, you know, again, links in with that workplace culture piece, but it's a really practical way to support people who are returning to work.
One of the other things you build on, and I think hopefully we can build in the other paper here, is about this career building. And I think that links really nicely into how this is all still very much a boys' club. And you talk about job security, but also about how kind of good lists are given away while you're on maternity leave. And, you know, I know that's happened to a colleague of mine that came back and found that all her lists have been changed. And how that affects both your confidence and also your career going forward. So I wonder if we could just bring in Jane and talk about a bit more about those issues of kind of gender equity and how women really aren't very supported in the current system.
Yeah, such a massive area, isn't it? Yeah. So I guess in terms of thinking about where are those inequities evident, I think, As Kara's alluded to, there are workplace laws in Australia which provide some protections, but I think there are a whole lot of, I guess, microaggressions or unconscious biases which affect how women receive opportunities, how they're supported to pursue leadership or encouraged to do research. I think one of the things we found was even something simple like non-clinical work. Actually, there's a massive gender difference that we observed in terms of what type of opportunities women have in their non-clinical time and how those are valued. So, for example, participants in the Boys Club paper identified that women are far more likely to be given well-being or welfare opportunities or education rather than research or leadership. And that sadly, other researchers also found that there's a conflation of status and gender. And so, you know, well-being and welfare and education are absolutely valuable, but they're not necessarily perceived as being valuable by the departments in which women hold those roles. And I think what would be interesting to look at is how are some of those metrics, how does that play out in departments, and are the differences in terms of remuneration or in terms of a physical space to do your non-clinical work, or how that's supported by administration? And thinking about, I guess, in every domain in terms of, clinical challenging lists, subspecialty areas, non-clinical work, are there gender differences there? And if so, why, and what can we do about them?
I see Lauren nodding her head. This is all very familiar to you.
I think it's such an important question, and One of the things you were discussing earlier in your paper is the negative impact on career trajectory. And these are the sorts of things that one of the important things to do at a leadership level is to make sure that you're putting in place systems to evaluate your institutional practices and saying, how am I assigning these opportunities? Am I opening it up to everyone, to asking who's interested? Am I tapping people on the shoulder? And what sort of thought process is going behind how these are assigned? Because there is definitely a difference in sort of non-promotional activities being assigned to women. And one of the, when you were talking about the negative impact on career trajectory, and then Kara was talking about women's confidence sort of returning from leave, it reminded me of this fantastic study that was done by Amy Oxentenko and others at the Mayo Clinic in the US, where they looked at trainee evaluations when they returned from having a baby, and they divided it up into sort of the birthing parent and the non-birthing parent, and the non-birthing parent was, you know, more often a man, and the birthing parent more often a woman. And so they looked at that study, and they looked at the trainee evaluations and returning from leave. Both parents are obviously have a newborn at home, are dealing with sleep deprivation. And there weren't sort of objective differences in performance upon returning, but the evaluations on the women were so much lower. They're sort of getting these very explicit messages. And it was clearly sort of based in bias and not based in objective reality. But potentially it had to do with having to leave intermittently for lactation, or sort of a perceived loss of abilities after, you know, returning from having a kid. But there are these very implicit and also explicit things that affect our career trajectory, which is definitely something that you have to, if you don't put systems in place to prevent that, then it's going to continue.
I think it was very interesting. One of the quotes that was in one of the papers was that the greatest burden of caregiving for our children has fallen to my wife to the detriment of her career and job satisfaction. I should and could have done much more.
Can I make a comment here to say, absolutely, one of the interesting parts of the Boys Club paper is that we also did a quantitative analysis on, you know, the Likert scales of whether you were satisfied or not satisfied. And fascinatingly, there is no gender difference when you actually ask people on a scale to say whether you're satisfied or not satisfied. But then in the thematic analysis, there is such clear commentary coming through that what the satisfaction scores may not do credit to are the sacrifices or resignation or challenges that women have come to and accepted to call that satisfied. And what they're saying they're satisfied with is actually a product of society's gendered norms and expectations rather than their internal satisfaction. And these are women who have done medical school, multiple specialist exams, and are highly competitive people. And yet for some reason, a caregiving responsibility suddenly changes all of their career and lifetime goals. And that was just a really fascinating thing to observe in the comparison between numbers and qualitative data.
It is fascinating. One of the things that I'm keen to look at is from the Boys Club paper, this idea that women don't fit the mold. And I think there was a quote that there was lots of middle-aged white men in positions of power in my department. They always employ people that look like them, and it's explained away as a good fit. And I think, Lauren, I was reading one of the pieces of work that you've done with Julie Silver about these strategies to enhance gender equity in kind of academic medicine. Could you talk a bit about that for us?
Absolutely. So yeah, this was a paper led by Julie Silver, who's an incredibly fantastic force in the gender equity space, and Jesse Allen, who is as well. They were looking at five different areas to work on to improve workforce gender equity from a structural level. And the paper was focused mostly on academic medicine, but I think is broadly applicable. And one of the important metrics was to actually look at division and departmental faculty metrics. So just like we were talking about earlier, how are extracurricular responsibilities being assigned? What's your pay scale? Is there a big gap in the pay or the productivity? And make sure that it's not being explained by sort of individual choices, but that, you know, make sure that there's no departmental influence of what assignments are being given, what opportunities. Another great concept was the stay interviews, which is something used more in the business world, where you conduct an interview with a faculty member and say, what would help you stay at this job? What are your goals for this job? What are things that, you know, fill your cup when coming to work, and what can we be doing more of and better, which is such an important thing to do. And, you know, I think should be anyone who's returning from any leave should have that opportunity to sit down with their division chief, because it might be as easy as saying, you know, I really want my kid in a, you know, a care facility, but it ends at 4. And is there any way we can adjust my hours? You know, those sorts of things. And that's certainly much better than having to bring someone else new in and making those adjustments. And then the other thing that we talked about was best practices and parental leave and return policies, which is the section that I contributed to most heavily. We're thinking through how do we make this sort of structural and systemic, so women aren't having to ask, they're not having to say, hey, can we build pumping time into this clinical schedule? You know, can we, you know, how many weeks do I have to get? That it's sort of, it's universal, it's set. So it's not the, responsibility is not placed on the individual to trailblaze. We talked about inviting mid-career women to publish with senior faculty as sort of a pulling up mentorship, and avoiding bias in faculty evaluations, because we know how much that bias can impact career trajectory.
The one thing I was just going to highlight, Cara, is, I mean, that's all true, but I think one comment you also had, which I found a bit more concerning, was from, I guess, one of the male respondents, which I've noticed an increasing tendency to discriminate against white male initiatives from various groups. And I'll just tell you an anecdote. A colleague of mine at the journal is a female researcher, and she makes an active policy of trying to involve female junior doctors in her research. And she gets a lot of comments about how she's anti-men. I mean, what do you say to that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I am actually married to a man, so I'm not anti all men. I work with some absolutely fantastic male colleagues and who I've got enormous respect for. There are plenty of men doing amazing things. That's the point, that there are plenty of men doing amazing things. There's lots of role models for men coming through. There's not as many role models for women, although that is increasing. And if you're a woman who is from a background that's underrepresented in medicine, there's even fewer for you. And if you're from, you know, if you've got gender diversity, or if you're from any other group that again is underrepresented in medicine, you know, that comes back to that trailblazing thing. So I'm not saying, and this, you know, is the bit that Jane talked about with the gender equity changes the status quo. There is some discomfort as we adjust and we adapt to the reality that, you know, our patient populations need our workforce to represent and understand them. And in Australia, that is particularly relevant. There's so much data about our First Nations people, our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients absolutely need representation.
I was just going to say, it's this concept that in order to achieve equity, you're taking from one side to balance the other side. And actually, the picture of equity is you take the highest bar and you try and bring everyone to that bar. So the concept is not to ever take away from any party. And there's been a fascinating, I mean, as an example of how you can achieve gender equity and benefit everyone, the state I live in, New South Wales, has a much broader parental leave description now, which means you no longer have to be the primary birthing partner to take the parental leave. So there's been a huge uptake of non-birthing partners who traditionally are male in taking parental leave. And what's been great is they've read the exact letter of the law. They've demanded to take it as flexibly as suits them. So for instance, they keep their one good list a week, but take their parental leave from every other list, so that they don't lose the one they want, but they do have time at home with their child. But by doing that, that is now that can be considered the standard, so that the women and non-binary people will be able to do the same. And I think that that's actually a fantastic thing that's happened to the system.
That's a great message to end on, because I'm afraid we are out of time, but it's been fascinating. I could spend all day talking to you ladies. So the Return to Work paper is already on early view on the Anaesthesia website. The Boys Club paper will be coming out imminently. And there is also an accompanying editorial, which has been written by Lauren and Julie Silver to accompany both papers that will be coming out hopefully on early view at the same time. So thank you very much, ladies, for giving up your time. And I hope you found it an enjoyable experience.
Thanks so much, Seema.
Thank you.
The Anaesthesia Podcast.